This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
If you weaken the U.S. dollar, that means that there'll be less purchasing with dollars of African exports. So African exporters won't be able to sell as much and get as much for their products.
That's Kevin Gallagher, professor of global development policy at Boston University, on the possible fallout if the U.S. Congress cannot agree on a deal for raising the country's debt limit. Details coming up. Also, Sudan awaits the latest effort to halt military clashes so civilians can seek aid or flee the fighting. And an outbreak of cholera has killed up to a dozen people near the South African capital. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Sudan residents are waiting to see if the latest ceasefire attempt will take hold tonight after others have failed. Fighting has pitted the army, led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, against the RSF, led by Burhan's former deputy, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Hameti. More than a million people have been displaced and millions more trapped, with limited access to water, electricity, and medicine. Both military leaders have refused to make concessions, raising concerns about a long conflict that could spread to Sudan's neighbors. An estimated 2,000 people already have been killed. After talks sponsored by the United States and Saudi Arabia, both sides have agreed to a week-long ceasefire starting at 9:45 p.m. local time to allow the delivery of humanitarian aid for civilians trapped by the fighting. Dagalo issued a statement today saying his forces will not retreat until the army ends what he called its coup. Aid agencies have struggled to operate amid the violence with facilities attacked during the conflict. The Sudanese Journalist Syndicate accused the RSF of robbing and attacking reporters last week. With the deadline for implementation of the ceasefire looming, Sudan's capital awoke today to the sound of airstrikes and anti-aircraft fire yet again. Clouds of black smoke billowed from a fire in the city of 5 million. Streets were nearly abandoned, most shops remained closed, and only intermittent water and power supplies were available in sweltering heat. Volker Perthes, the United Nations envoy to Sudan, warned of the growing ethnicization of the military conflict amid concerns about the potential impact in neighboring states who already are trying to cope with waves of refugees from the fighting. During a briefing before the UN Security Council opened a meeting on the conflict, Perthes said ethnicity risks engulfing the country in a prolonged conflict with implications for the region. Reporter Sadimir Ibrahim has this report from Khartoum.
For more than 20 days, the citizens of Khartoum have been suffering very difficult conditions after closing the main markets due to the war between the Sudanese army and the rebel support forces. Most of the citizens complain about the lack of basic needs, like bread and food, whose prices have become very expensive and difficult for poor people to buy. While the security situation is getting worse due to some looting accidents of shops and stores, with international warnings of a humanitarian disaster in Khartoum, people hope that the conditions will improve, so that they can return to live their normal lives in peace. For Voice of America, Sid Ahmed Ibrahim, Khartoum.
Unlike earlier truces that fell apart or never took hold at all, the U.S. and Saudi said this one is different because it was signed by the parties and will be supported by a ceasefire monitoring mechanism. According to a text of the agreement released by the U.S., warring sides were to use the 2 days before it takes effect Monday night to inform their respective forces about it and instruct them to comply. Both sides also conveyed to the Saudi and U.S. facilitators their commitment not to seek military advantage during the 48 hours leading up to the ceasefire, a U.S.-Saudi statement said. The U.N. Security Council got a briefing this morning from Volker Perthes, the UN Special Representative for Sudan, on the latest situation in Sudan and the conflict-ridden country. Saudi Arabia and the U.S. announced on Saturday in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, that representatives of Sudan's armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces signed an agreement on a short-term ceasefire and humanitarian arrangements. VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir says Perthes came to New York in the midst of the deadly conflict and was scheduled to brief the council behind closed doors later today.
He said that the conflict has shown no signs of slowing down, despite the repeated declarations of ceasefires over these past 5 weeks by both parties. So this latest one that you mentioned that was signed Saturday in Jeddah, it's due to go into effect at 9:45 p.m. local time, Monday in Sudan. So that has not happened quite yet. And Mr. Perthes said there'd also be a basic monitoring mechanism for the ceasefire, which is very important in maintaining ceasefires. And that would be between the army and the RSF and the mediators, so presumably the United States and Saudi Arabia. And this ceasefire is supposed to last for 7 days, and it is renewable. And the goal is to allow civilians to move around, because so many people have been trapped in their homes for weeks now, and also for the aid workers to access people in need, because let's not forget, supplies have run out, services like power and water have been cut, and there's more than a million people internally displaced now in Sudan. 250,000 people have fled, so it's quite chaotic. So they need to be able to reach people. However, Mr. Perthes said that fighting and troop movements did continue on Monday, according to his information, despite both sides committing to not pursuing a military advantage before the ceasefire takes effect. So I don't know if that bodes badly for the ceasefire or if they're all trying to get it out of their system before the ceasefire takes effect, which often happens.
So as you say, people have been trapped for over a month in their homes, all kinds of people, civilians and aid workers. Did Perthes say that the conditions, did he make any mention that the conditions are any better in the capital, Khartoum, or elsewhere than they were a few weeks ago?
No, he didn't really go into specifics, but we have heard from the UN over the last, I'd say, week to 10 days, maybe, that they're starting to kind of restart aid operations, scaling up some. They're able now to get some supplies into the country. They've restarted the UN Humanitarian Air Service, which are the UN air flights that bring in aid. There's also boats running between Port Sudan in the east and, for instance, Saudi Arabia, where they can move supplies in and out. And staff, by the way, because you need to bring in more staff, you need to rotate people in and out. So there's a lot of logistics involved.
Is this latest ceasefire that was signed by both sides mainly aimed at setting up humanitarian corridors, or does it go further than that?
For now, my understanding is that it's basically to get allow civilians to move and aid workers the access they need to deliver supplies.
That's VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam from New York. The French news agency AFP reports that gunmen carried out an attack in eastern Burkina Faso that left more than a dozen people dead, the latest in a week-long stretch of violence that has killed more than 70 people. AFP cited local sources and said security sources confirmed the attack yesterday on the outskirts of Compiègne, the capital of the province of the same name. The victims are believed to be mostly shepherds. Several other attacks have each claimed at least 10 lives since last Monday. Burkina Faso has been struggling with a jihadist insurgency that swept in from neighboring Mali in 2015. A few weeks ago, Zimbabwe's Reserve Bank introduced a cryptocurrency using digital gold coins. The value of the currency, it said, was supported by gold owned by the bank. But financial experts are dubious, and the Reserve Bank's plan does not seem to be working. Darren Taylor reports.
The Reserve Bank says that digital gold tokens can be used as a means of payment and to store value. It says the cryptocurrency will slow demand for US dollars, which they blame for driving high inflation. South African cyber finance expert Jan Vermeulen says Zimbabwean banks are selling the tokens in both foreign currency and local dollars. The banks, he says, are creating specific accounts known as e-gold wallets or e-gold cards to hold the digital tokens. Unsurprisingly, says Vermeulen, there hasn't been a lot of demand for the accounts.
What this strikes me as is it's not really a cryptocurrency. It's more like a digital Krugerrand. I can't find the blockchain. I can't find any public record of transactions. And I have no way of verifying that there's actually gold behind these tokens. There are a bunch of red flags here.
Economist at the Friedrich Naumann Foundation in Harare, Fungisai Sithole, says if the Reserve Bank is to be believed, it has bought 140 kilograms of Zimbabwe's 350 kilograms of gold reserves to back the cryptocurrency.
We are taking away from our reserves, which means this will also have a long-term implication as our reserves continue to deplete, as it were. We are trying to put a bandage on a wound that is really, really infested and on an economy that is really, really degenerating. So I really think we are trying to fix our monetary situation, our currency situation, without really dealing with the underlying dynamics that we need to deal with as a nation.
In a statement on May 12th, the Reserve Bank said it had sold gold tokens to the full value of the 140 kilograms of gold it had in storage, proving that the public trusted its cryptocurrency. But like the International Monetary Fund, Sithole is convinced Zimbabwe's economic problems will only be solved once there's political reform, not by introducing a mysterious cryptocurrency. She says demand for the gold tokens is low because citizens don't have faith in them.
We've had the gold coins since July 2022, and they have not worked. They suffered the trust deficit. At least they were better because they were physical. And if you're in Zimbabwe, if you're to get a physical gold coin, at least you have something, you know, to assure you that I can trust the process.
Sithole says Zimbabwe's government is trying to control the markets, which is impossible. The path to a stable currency and economy, she insists, lies chiefly in free and fair elections. Other economists say even if the gold cyber coins become popular, they'll eventually be susceptible to the same volatility plaguing the Zimbabwean economy. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The French news agency AFP says Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari today commissioned an oil plant billed as Africa's largest oil refinery after years of delays and a week before he leaves office. Built by Africa's richest person, Aliko Dangote, in the commercial hub of Lagos, the refinery should begin operations in June with the first products expected on the market by August, though some analysts told AFP it could be later. Once at full capacity, it will have the ability to process 650,000 barrels a day, according to the company. Buhari, who steps down next Monday after 8 years in office, described the project as a notable milestone and a game changer for the downstream petroleum products market, not only in Nigeria, but for the entire African continent. AFP says the presidents of Ghana, Niger, Togo, Senegal, and a representative of the Chadian leader were present at the commissioning. The refinery is expected to meet Nigeria's domestic demand as well as serve global markets, Dangote said. President-elect Bola Tinubu, whose February victory is being contested by the opposition, has said that he would remove subsidies once in office. He was not present at the commissioning. Also on the massive complex is a $2 billion fertilizer plant with a 3 million tons per annum capacity. More than 100,000 direct and indirect jobs are expected to be created through the project, according to the Lagos state government. South African health authorities have warned citizens to take extreme precautions as an outbreak of cholera has killed up to a dozen people and raised fears that it could spread to other parts of the country. Residents of the most affected township, Hamanskaral, just outside Pretoria, have been cautioned not to touch tap water given strong suspicions the infection is coming out of their faucets. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The cholera outbreak has brought grief to many families and triggered panic across the country. Hamanskaral Township is the worst affected, with residents commuting daily to Pretoria for work and other needs. There are fears it could easily spread to the capital. Dozens have been hospitalized. The local Jubilee Hospital says it has treated over 100 people showing symptoms of cholera such as diarrhea, vomiting, fever and dehydration. Nomantu Nkomo Ralehoko, a member of the Gauteng Provincial Government's Executive Council responsible for health, spoke to journalists during her visit to the affected areas.
We are going to the communities just to make sure that they drink clean water and they must boil their water when they are drinking it. And the municipality is assisting us with the trucks that are coming to deliver water in their area.
Meanwhile, the communities in Hamanskaral Township are angry over the outbreak and loss of loved ones. For years, they have complained about the various illnesses caused by their visible and clean water, but the calls fell on deaf ears. South Africa's neighbors like Zimbabwe, Mozambique, and Malawi have also reported cholera cases, raising concerns that the disease could jump borders. In 2008, South Africa had up to 12,000 cases of cholera after an outbreak that killed thousands in Zimbabwe. Reporting for VOA News in Johannesburg, I am Tuso Kumalo.
A young Ugandan man orphaned at childhood dreams of playing in U.S. Major League Baseball and has turned his training into a social media sensation. 18-year-old Dennis Kasumba, who earns a living by cleaning cow sheds, cannot afford professional equipment, so he uses old tires and oil drums filled with water to train. He recently got news that will bring him one step closer to his dream, as Halima Atumani reports from Wakiso District in Uganda.
Opportunity often comes to those who are prepared, and Ugandan baseball player Dennis Kasumba, who grew up as an orphan, lives up to this adage. Training three times a day, Kasumba, who has become a social media sensation among baseball fans, has created his own gym, improvising with everything that can make him a better and stronger player. Kasumba recalls one of his videos that went viral, earning him a spot on the U.S. television show SportsCenter. I had my phone pinging and wondered what was going on. Little did I know my video had been played on the biggest television stations in America. He says, as I was walking to the field, colleagues called me out saying, SportsCenter was relaying your video. Have you watched it? I told them, my family doesn't own a television set. He is starting to see his efforts pay off. Kasumba has received an invitation to play with a U.S. team, the Frederick Keys, in the state of Maryland in an amateur league over the summer season starting June 1st. He is already building an American fan base. One of the people who was impressed by Kasumba's videos is baseball fan and lawyer Joshua William from Atlanta in the U.S. state of Georgia, who spoke to VOA via Zoom.
My sons play travel baseball, and we were traveling for a tournament down in Florida, and I was just scrolling through my phone, and I saw one of Kasumba's videos and was just like, wow, this kid is really good. And so I just kind of reached out to him through Facebook, and we started talking, and he started telling me his dreams of, you know, how he wants to play baseball professionally.
Since then,
over the weekend, the BAL kicked off its playoff in Kigali, Rwanda. The clash of the Sahara and Nile conferences began on Saturday, and to say it wasn't eventful is speaking of it very lightly. In the studio, I have sports analyst my colleague, Mokbele Baro, to give us a recap of the games. Welcome to African News Tonight, Mokbele.
Thank you for having me, Yehias.
So, Mokbele, can you go over the results of the BAL playoff results for us?
Yes, Stade Malien from Mali defeated the Cape Town Tigers 78-69 in the first game. Al Ahli from Egypt beat Rwanda Energy Group 94-77. AS Douan 93-73 against Mozambican side CFV Beira. And Petro de Luanda, the Angolan side, in a thrilling game, beat Abidjan Basketball Club Ivory Coast side 88-84. Came down to the wire.
Came down to the wire. So now what are the matchups for the next round and how do you think they turned out?
I believe the next matchups will be Petro de Luanda versus AS Douan and Stade Malien versus Al Ahli. Man, these are going to be two exciting teams, Yehias. You have two Nile Conference teams and two Sahara Conference teams showing us that both the Nile Conference and the Sahara Conference are both equally matched. And honestly, it's exciting. Stade Malien and Al Ahli both debutant teams. First time in the competition, making it all the way to the to this round of the playoffs. If with one more win, both teams are in the finals.
Who are some key players from the teams that have advanced?
So I would say, keeping it with Stade Malien, you have Aliou Diarra and Solomon Berthe, two young studs from the Stade Malien side. For the Petro de Luanda side, I would say Carlos Moraes and Diabate. From the AS Douanes side, you have Marcus Crawford. And last but definitely not least for Al Ahli, you have the young stunner. His name is Nouni Omat from South Sudan. He's been balling out.
I like the name, Nouni Omat.
Yes, sir.
Lastly, what are your predictions on the upcoming games?
Honestly, yes, this is going to be tough. You know, I actually had a conversation with our colleague, Sheikh Tiero, the big man. He's over in Kigali, Rwanda, and we were talking about this as well. It's anyone's match. The beauty of this tournament, especially this season, is that you have a plethora of skilled teams, a plethora of skilled players, and it's very difficult to call because any single game is exactly what it is. It's just a one-game knockout type of style. It's not a series like the NBA. So because of that, you know, if you just come in and you play your style of the game defensively, I think it's going to come down to defense. If you're able to defend the correct way, then you will win. If I had to put a prediction, you know, I don't like these, but if I had to,
yes, please.
I would have to say that Petro de Luanda, you know, having had the experience, the Angolan side, this is their third time playing in this tournament. So this might be their, you know, their go around. The first season, they didn't go too far. Last season, they went all the way to the finals and lost to U.S. Monastir. This season might be their season where they take everything. So Petro, possibly.
Possibly.
We will see, man.
But who do you think will be in the finals and potentially win the BAL season 3?
Yeah, like, so if I'm rolling with Petro on one side against AS Douanes, which is obviously still a very, very skilled team as well, so I can't knock them out. But if I were to say Petro from that side, this Stade Malien and Al Ahli team, man, it's tough. This one, I would say, man, maybe Al Ahli. Maybe Al Ahli. And then that would potentially be a rematch from the toughest, most closest game that we've had in the tournament that went down to a buzzer beater between Petro de Luanda and Al Ahli. We get to see the two teams go back at it again. It's going to be exciting.
A plethora of talents. VOA sports analyst Mokbele Baro, thank you for your input. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nicole Beckford, and our engineer, Cornelius Tenner, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.